Wing Riders, please enjoy. Good afternoon. If you're just tuning in, material girls and material boys out there, I'm so glad you did, because you've got Living Writers on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. And today, Aria Aber is here in the studio to talk about her book of poems out with Prairie Schooner University of Nebraska Press, Hard Damage, and also many other things. Maybe the upcoming novel as well, a little bit later on. Aria, thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me. I'm very excited.
And well, and thanks for choosing the music for today's program.
Of course.
So, do you? Why Madonna? What was the reason for this one?
I really used to like this song as a teenager, and I haven't really returned to it in a while, but a couple of years ago, I don't know why it started popping up again in my head. I just had it stuck in my head, and I started listening to a lot of Madonna again, even though I had grown out of that phase, and I just remembered how amazing she is and how fun her music is, truly. And Material Girl, I mean, it's just a classic, you know?
It is. It's like the MTV time too, when you see like the video of her.
Yes, exactly. And,
I actually just bought, this is like confession time, Lucky Star or Borderline again, or Lucky Star. I forget the name of the album, but that earlier album at like a record sale, and I was so excited.
I love that.
Yeah. Anyway, it's good to have albums again too.
Absolutely. Yes. Yes. I need to get a new record player. Mine broke, but
yes, God, it's worth it.
I know, it really is. It's absolutely a different experience to be forced to listen to an album from beginning to end.
I love how you say forced.
Well, you have no other choice, you know. Digitally, you can just skip around, but I guess you could place the needle elsewhere. But
that's true, yeah. But at the risk, of like doing. It's kind of interesting to think also of books of poems too, because when we're, you know, making a book, you kind of and constructing it, you're choosing where these poems are, and there's meaning behind it. But with a book, I mean, when it goes out in the world, you hope that maybe people will. Well, what do you hope for Hard? What was it like for you with Hard Damage?
That is such a good question. And also something I was just thinking about this week is the experience of reading a poetry collection, because I rarely sit down and read a poetry collection the way I would read a novel, because there is no expectation of linearity in the same way, right? People regard it as like this collection of scattered things, and you can just open up a page and encounter the poem individually. But of course, as a writer, when you put together a collection, it has meaning. You know, the sequence of poems has a big meaning. And I know that some poets, very famous ones whom I will not name, sometimes just use a chronological order in order to sequence their work in a collection. But I was more inspired by a kind of like narrativistic structure. And I was actually inspired by fiction and by the novels that I was reading. While putting together the collection, I did, for example, the first poem that starts the collection is a poem about childhood, right? And then I move through childhood through like different themes. And by the end of the book, I feel like the speaker has changed a little bit.
And so what were you reading? What was the inspiration? Like when you say you were reading some novels, or is it more the feeling of it, but you
it was more the feeling. It was more the feeling of it. I didn't have like a particular novel in mind while I was putting together the structure. I think I was honestly just thinking about a traditional hero's journey from childhood to adulthood. And that's what inspired the structure in the novel, because I did have this instinct that my speaker was caught in a world that is familial. There are characters in it that recur. There is a mother figure. There is a father figure. At some point, I didn't have enough poems about the mother, which triggered, for example, the very long sequence in the middle that is also about Rilke. It's kind of like a nonfiction piece called Rilke and I, and it's about my mother's experiences in Afghanistan. And I didn't have that.
And in prison.
Yeah. Yes. My mother was in prison. She was an activist in her early 20s. Actually, her entire side of the family was politically active during the Soviet occupation in Afghanistan. They were socialists, but independent, and were against the puppet government at that time. And they were active with different organizations, and she was imprisoned, so was her sister, her brother, and so on. But it's kind of a strange history to have been born into an exile in Germany. You know, like I wasn't raised in Afghanistan, and I hadn't seen the country until after this book was out. So in some ways I was writing towards this unseen home, as many people in the diaspora do. But there were so many stories that had shaped my life that I didn't really have access to. And I think that's also why narrative and fiction came into play while writing this book, and why there are so many different forms of poems within the book. And I'm not just writing a typical lyrical poem, but I have, for example, also a very long documentary sequence that deals with Operation Cyclone, which was a covert operation by the CIA, which eventually led to the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. So it's all very complicated,
yes.
But it influenced the book in some way and makes its texture so rich and cacophonous at points, I would say.
Oh, I love that that's a great way to say it. Well,
yeah.
I mean, you would know. Cacophonous.
But I don't think I have used that word before to describe the book as a whole. I think I have a cacophonous music in the poems, but I also, now thinking about it, I think the book is structured in a cacophonous way.
Well, and why? I mean, it feels like you're telling us why that is too.
Well, I just don't think there's a neat way to talk about war and exile. And I'm not interested in a neat way of, like, I think, flattening or reducing a narrative that to me is very complex and loud. But also, I think, before I saw Afghanistan and Kabul, I was filled with a kind of anger and righteousness that afterwards was extinguished. I don't know whether it was the writing of the book that produced this cathartic experience in me, or the fact that I finally went and saw Kabul and Afghanistan and realized that maybe it wasn't my place to write about all of these things. I don't regret it at all. I think it was extremely important to write this book, but and I love the book and I love the poems. I have gone through phases where I've hated it, but I think that's normal with any type of art you create, you know. But yeah, that's, I think the anger came into it, but also aesthetically, I was not interested in a flat and a neat way. And I don't think a lyric poem alone can contain all the political aspects that I was interested in exploring.
Right. It might take the edges off of it in some way, because right. there'd be other things at work that might distract from it, whereas there might need to be things that are plain spoken or structured differently. Like when you list towards the latter half of the book with the starting from quite early on, lists of the U.S. covert actions yes. across the globe.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I actually just lifted that from Wikipedia, like open source, you know. I saw that list and I was reading it out loud to myself and I thought, oh my God, this is musical. Mm. And it's actually estranging. Mm. It's kind of a found poem and it frames the documentary poem, you know, in the middle of the book. And I mean, it's interesting to work as a poet and not as a musician, because sound is everywhere too, when we were just talking about albums, but language is everywhere too. And it's the way we express ourselves and the way politicians express themselves and like manipulate people, you know. So poets use the same tools. We work with the same kind of devices that politicians use. And ideally, we are on the opposite end of the spectrum, where we try to get closer to the truth and not obscure it, you know.
And that's also getting closer to the truth. That's not easy. And it's not even saying that you arrive at the truth.
Yes, exactly.
Which I think is why it necessitates this cacophony then, that you're or
I agree.
So, or
yes,
what
I agree. I agree.
The troubled parts or the parts right. that aren't smoothly fitted. Like,
yeah,
you can't have an easy truth. And it's wonderful how you talk about Rilke so much. It's complicated too in here, and so informative. Like, I'm someone who from a young person has also like loved Rilke and, you know, Letters to a Young Poet,
of course,
things, right?
Yes, they're absolutely
touchstones. But to think also about his like, you address things that are difficult about
right.
the edges of Rilke that, you know, you don't even hear in the name, because the name itself sounds so smooth.
I
and
know, beautiful.
Lyrical.
Yes.
But, you know, abandoning your wife and newborn or so, and there's lines where you'll say cheating everyone to get to make a life,
yeah,
with the poems, with art, with God.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I think as a female artist, a woman writer, you're grappling with what it means to give up everything in order to, I don't know, see the sublime transcend somehow in your own work, but also the way we think of art monsters, as I like to call them. It's not my own term. I don't know who came up with it. Jenny Offal uses it in Department of Speculation. Great book. Highly recommend. But art monsters. Rilke definitely was one, right?
Because, and you have it in your poems this way.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I think so, because yeah. I just read it.
Oh, that is so funny. I didn't even know that I was using that phrase in the poems. But yeah, he is... Yeah, he was that kind of person. Nabokov was that kind of person too. You know, he didn't even type up his own letters. Like, his wife would do everything for him. And when when you're the woman in the relationship, or when you're a woman in the world and you're like just, you know, faced with so many different kinds of gendered responsibilities, or like constantly being pushed into gendered roles, there is a question of like, how much do I want to sacrifice for the art, and how will I be perceived? Because I am, even in 2024, going against the grain somewhat, you know. Maybe it's become more normalized for women to be art monsters too, but it's just interesting because I also want to draw, I mean, I don't think I want to draw a line, but explore the questions about ethics and what it means to be an artist in the world. Not just, oh, how do I become an art monster, but also is it good to be an art monster? Are there other things in life that matter? Will I always choose the poem over people, or should I not do that? You know, those are questions that always concern me.
And what would this poem be too? That
yeah,
you're creating,
that I've chosen over people.
Yes.
Right. Yes. Well, yeah, exactly.
In some of the poems, you have, I think, the father at one point and the mother at one point. The father saying, I think you can go, you know, like to be your own, you might have to leave. You might have to leave everything
right.
to be the artist.
Yes.
And that can be like a worthy, valuable path.
Yes.
And then I think several much further in, then we have the mother emailing the speaker a poem. Or no, sorry, not a poem, an article about a woman who abandons her family to go live in a cottage to write a book.
Yes.
So I feel like in some ways, you maybe the speaker is having support from the family that's in the book.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely in my own life did have the support. My family has been incredibly supportive of me doing my own thing. You know, they never pressured me towards a traditional role for a woman in the world, and they still don't. And I'm very lucky that way. And I have a supportive partner now, too. But at the same time, I do also wonder. I mean, I think my opinions have changed the older I've gotten, because 5 years ago or 6 years ago, I would have said I would choose art over people any day, but I don't feel that way anymore. You know, I think the pandemic has changed a lot of people. There was this transformative period of collective grief, and things happened in my life. I lost loved ones, and I think now looking back, I would say, yeah, no, I would, you know, you don't have to sacrifice one for the other. I think being a better human ultimately makes you a better artist, too.
We'll take a short break. Today on Living Writers, Aria Eber is here. Her book of poems, Hard Damage, on the table here with us. We've got Jason behind the glass. We'll be back. Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, I'm so glad you did. Today, Aria Eber is here. Her book of poems, Hard Damage, out with University of Nebraska Press. Aria, thanks for being here today. Before we get talking, I'm going to read your bio from your website. And folks, you can go check out the website too, ariaeber.com. And there's a great photo, maybe we can talk about that in a moment, on the About the Author page. Aria Eber was born and raised in Germany and is currently based in Los Angeles, California. Her debut book, the poetry collection Hard Damage, won the Prairie Schooner Book Prize in Poetry and a 2020 Whiting Award. Her poems are forthcoming or have appeared in The New Yorker, New Republic, The Yale Review, and elsewhere. a graduate of the NYU MFA in creative writing. She holds awards and fellowships from Kudamin, the Wisconsin Institute of Creative Writing, and the Wallace Stegner Fellowship at Stanford. Her first novel, Good Girl, is forthcoming from Hogarth and Bloomsbury in 2025 and will be translated into 6 languages. So thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And you flew in today from LA, and you're here for the Zelle Visiting Writers series. You'll be, let's see, tomorrow on Thursday, you'll be doing a reading, and possibly will it be a Q&A too?
There will be a Q&A after the reading, and on Friday I'm doing a craft talk. Yes.
So you can check out Zelle Visiting Writers series to find the exact times and locations. Tomorrow's event will be at UMA, and that will be at 5:30. So y'all can put that on your dance card. Okay. So Aria, this photo, do you mind describing it for us a little bit?
Well, it's an analog picture taken on 35mm film on my Olympus point and shoot, which I think I bought at a flea market in Berlin in, I don't know when, 10 years ago maybe. And I am standing in front of the Pacific Ocean in Santa Barbara. I'm pretty backlit, so I look a little shady, and I blend in with the shrubbery in front of the ocean, and I'm looking to the floor. And my partner, Noah Warren, took this picture in January of last year, I think. I think I was in a bad mood when the picture was taken, but once I saw the film after it was developed, I was very happy about it.
Ah, good old Noah.
Yes.
Because the ocean is so beautiful there.
I know. It's like Santa Barbara is magical. I mean, I've never seen a more beautiful place, I think. It's just gorgeous.
Well, how is LA suiting you?
I like LA a lot.
No, sorry. Now it feels like a setup. I didn't mean to. Well, it's no Santa Barbara.
No. But I mean, it's not. But I guess it could be if I live by the beach. I don't.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Right.
I don't live by the beach. I live in Highland Park, and I like it. It's on the east side. It's a lot of driving, which I, as a European, am not used to. But otherwise, I love it.
Yeah, it's kind of a place to be too.
Yes,
it's, you know, well. So when you say as a European, are you thinking of Germany? Because is that a lot of your formative years, Aria?
Yes, I was born in Germany and I lived there until I was 20. And then again, a couple of years ago, I moved back to Berlin, and I lived in London for 5 years after that, before I moved to the U.S. in 2016. So I lived in Europe for the first 25 years of my life, and that's still where my family is and where I go back twice a year. And it's Germany is the country of my citizenship, you know, that's my passport. So yeah, I do consider myself European in that sense. I mean, of course, I'm an Afghan and I'm an exile in Europe too, but there are a lot of things in which I don't feel American, you know, and feel more European. But they're quite small, and I'm happy to be here also. But yeah. It's interesting because I think once I went and saw Afghanistan in person, I realized, oh, I am just a third world child in some ways. You know, I'm a European who was born to immigrants and thus had like a kind of different experience. But there is definitely the coalescence of nature versus nurture. There are a lot of aspects about my personality and my behavior and what I need in the world that are, I think, shaped by German culture European values.
And so when you went to Kabul, then did you, because it was, you've had this you had this book of poems. Hard Damage was made. It was in the world.
It actually came out while I was there.
Really?
I know.
Wow.
I know. Isn't that quite crazy?
That is really something.
I know. That's... It wasn't planned to be that way, but it just happened. Yeah.
So did that make it even more intense then, do you think?
Probably. Yeah. I mean, it's also just, it was an intense place in 2019, even though technically the country, yeah, I mean, the country was at war in a different way than it is now when the troops have gone, but the Taliban have taken over, which presents its own set of problems. You know, concepts such as liberty or freedom are never abstract. They mean something entirely different on the ground. But it was a strange time because Trump was already talking about like a peace deal with the Taliban, you know, like to end the occupation there. And I don't know. I mean, it's interesting because I also don't have any family left there anymore. So I went with my father and my sister, and we stayed with family, friends. And it was a wonderful experience. It's beautiful still, but also it's completely destroyed, you know. So it was kind of like walking through ruins, even though there are parts of it that are maintained. So you see that it's possible. There is, for example, like a large garden that was protected by, I think, private money, really. And it hasn't been affected, or it was rebuilt. I don't know if it was... you go in and you're behind these marble walls, and it feels as though there is no war happening because you don't hear like the strange sounds from the city, and you don't see men and guns walking around, you know. But there are moments you can pass through the city for hours and not know that you're in a country that's at war, technically, you know. It's just mm-hmm. like suddenly the presence of rifles or guns or like military gear reminds you of the fact. But I think that's true for a lot of countries in the Middle East. Yeah.
Earlier, Arya, you had mentioned that the stories from Afghanistan had shaped your life, like growing up in Germany, and but you felt like you didn't have access to them. And I wondered about that, because reading Hard Damage, it feels like you gave yourself access to them, like you asked people, or you talked with people, or you researched, or you spent the time in your own mind and heart really being in these spaces.
It's true. I did. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like it's funny to think of access, you know, like what do I even mean by that? I'm not sure. Yeah, I did have that. I guess the question is, oh, have I lived through them? You know, like, have I lived through these stories, or have I seen the country where these like stories have occurred? Have I, like, it's very elemental in some way. I'm like, have I smelled the country? Mm. Have I like seen what the light looks like there? Have I, and I hadn't, and I didn't know what it would feel like to walk through the streets in Kabul, or to even taste the food there. You know, I'm like, oh, my mother's food is better than the food back in the country. Things like that. I mean, it's very interesting. Because I did do a lot of research. I talked to people, I interviewed people, I like unearthed documents that they were freely accessible, but I had to go to libraries or, you know, and into online archives and stuff like that. I watched a lot of documentaries. I looked through family photos. I did do my, you know, I did do my own work in order to arrive at this book and arrive at the material for this book. But it also felt like something, I mean, I think there's something interesting about growing up in exile, especially with such a wealth of stories as my family has, because sometimes they conflict each other with certain details, and you just realize that everyone has their own memory for something. And so it just becomes this prismatic tapestry of stories, you know, and they're mostly all the same, but then certain details change, or the same person tells the same story twice, and it's a Tuesday afternoon, and then the next time it's a Saturday evening, and there's a sun, you know, like a detail like a sunset suddenly enters the story that wasn't there before, and you wonder, oh, where did that mix-up come from, or something like that. I'm just interested in those slippery moments, you know?
Yes, and there's a moment in one of your poems here too, Aria, where you say the speaker realizes the mother is an unreliable narrator.
Yes.
Which I think speaks to this.
Absolutely,
too.
Yeah.
Even if, like, in this case, I think part of it was fairy tale as well as not maybe telling the family stories.
Yes.
But our memories, every time we rethink it, it becomes a new telling of it,
absolutely,
a new version.
And and it depends on the time of the day when you're telling the story too, you know, or like the mood you have while recalling that memory, you know, it's and you change and the world changes you, and somehow that affects the way that you experience or recall the past, which is just, the brain is a fascinating thing.
It is, and it makes us all so unreliable,
doesn't it? It really does.
I mean, we could be earnest, but we might, maybe we shouldn't. What is truth?
Exactly, what is truth? We will never know.
Let's take a short break on that note. Today on Living Writers, Aria Aber is here. Her book of poems, Hard Damage, out with University of Nebraska Press. You're listening to Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel. We've got Jason behind the glass, and we'll be back. Back, you've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel. Today on the program, Aria Aber is here in the studio. Hard Damage, her book of poems, on the table with us. Aria, I love talking with you. Could we hear some poems?
Of course, of course. I will read a poem called Afghan Funeral in Paris, which I wrote out of rebellion, I think. But I'm going to talk about it later. Let me just read the poem first. Afghan Funeral in Paris. The aunts here clink Malbec glasses and parade their grief with musky, expensive scents that whisper in elevators and hallways. Each natural passing articulates the unnatural. Every aunt has a son who fell, or a daughter who hid in rubble for 2 years, until that knock of officers holding a bin bag filled with a dress and bones. But what do I know? I get pedicures and eat croissants while reading Swan's Way. When I tell one aunt I'd like to go back, she screams, "It is not yours to want." "Have some cream cheese with that," says another. Oh, what wonder to be alive and see my father's footprints in his sister's garden. He's furiously scissoring the hyacinths, saying all the time when the teleresearcher asks him, "How often do you think your life
as a mistake. During the procession, the aunts' wails vibrate. Wires full of crows and heavy wind. I hate every plumed minute of it. God invented everything out of nothing, but the nothing shines through, said Paul Valéry. Paris never charmed me, but when some stranger asks if it stinks in Afghanistan, I am so shocked that I hug him, and he lets me, his ankles briefly brushing against mine.
Thank you, Aria.
You're welcome.
Rebellion.
Rebellion. Well, I was just encountering a lot of poems that were romanticizing Paris, and my experience of Paris and of Berlin and of certain other European cities that are very popular to tourists, especially from America, is quite different because I was raised in a very big immigrant family and we were scattered. Afghans are everywhere. And so when we would travel, we would usually just go and see another Afghan family in another city in Europe. And it would be for a wedding or a funeral or some other kind of big life event. And I would usually not experience the city the way a normal tourist would, right? I would like be, I would dive immediately into its underbelly, which is a little... It's dirtier, it's messy, it's not as romantic, especially Paris is kind of, it has a really ugly side to it, which I love. I really like Paris, actually, but I don't like the sheen that people are, I think, referring to when they look at it from far away. So I was interested in writing a Paris poem the way I see it or the way I experience it. And so the funeral as a setting felt appropriate, even though it didn't happen. Like, this is not an autobiographical poem. It didn't happen exactly this way, but there are many autobiographical elements that I've just stitched together.
When you're writing that, so you're going with a feeling that yes. you want to capture.
It depends. Well, with this poem in particular, like with this poem, the first couple of lines were already there. And I wanted to write a poem about Paris, but I didn't know where it was going to lead me. But yeah, I usually start with the sounds before an image comes or before even meaning arrives. Like, yeah, when I write poetry, I follow the sound.
And could you read the first couple of lines again, Aria?
Sure. The aunts here clink Malbec glasses and parade their grief with musky, expensive scents that whisper in elevators and hallways.
So yes, it's full of the sound of yeah. it, isn't it?
Yeah. And the S sounds, which are kind of repeated throughout the rest of the poem too, you know, with the expensive and the musky and the glasses and the whisper.
Yes. And so then you're finding, like, you're trusting, like, these sounds that are coming to you.
Mm-hmm.
And then with the language of it, you're finding your way.
I assume so. I wish there was I had a more eloquent or logical way to talk about it. But it feels that way. I usually start with a couple of lines and I follow them. Like, I try to do something that the poet Eduardo C. Quirrell said is to follow the music. And I try to do that, you know, like, let the line guide you to where it wants to go. Because oftentimes when we want to follow logic in poetry or follow linearity in poetry, we impede from the poem becoming surprising to ourselves. And I think that's what I go to the page where I write in order to find out what I don't know. And sometimes I just leave with more questions, you know, oftentimes, and hopefully the poem doesn't answer anything, but it surprises me in some way. And when I follow the music, that's what happens more often than not.
And then the poem can become more itself.
Yes, exactly.
And it can have like a feeling
yeah.
that's conveyed. So this is wonderful, Aria. It's interesting, too, how when you first described the book, too, you said like a narrative. There was a longer phrase, but with narrative taking a lead, which can sometimes then become a force as well.
Yes.
That wants what it wants.
Yes.
And so how, because it sounds like you're combating it here in this poem by saying, well, some of these are autobiographical moments, but they're not happening in this moment or so.
It's interesting because I guess there is like the macroscopic structuring, or like you have like authorial power over the book in a macroscopic way, which is the structure of like once the poems are all, you know, done, like, or once the majority of the poems are done, how do I put them next to each other? And then in the like more immediate way of like writing the actual poem, I try not to think so much about anything. And there was the moment where I thought, okay, I have to write into the mother figure, right? But I didn't know that it would be a nonfiction, like it would be more nonfiction-esque rather than a lyrical poem, or it would be more prosy, or that it would include Rilke or a translation or the German language. All of that happened more or less organically while writing towards other prompts. And, you know, I'm a very intuitive writer. And I think the process of creation is usually very chaotic, and I try to like just let my subconscious guide me and be very, I'm a maximalist. I try to produce as much as possible during my first couple of drafts and then pare back. And then I try to be more of my editor self and prune and be colder and cut away and like structure things. But I think it's important when you approach the like the empty page to be wild and to allow yourself to, you know, like just accept it as a wilderness.
How do you think you found that? Is that part of like your spirit of just also being you in the world? And so you bring that to your making?
I think so. I feel like it's, yeah, I think I probably can't choose. Yeah, you probably can't choose your process the same way that you probably can't choose your obsessions or your aesthetic preferences. Things like that are more or less innate, or they're shaped by your life and you're drawn to them. And I think it's important to be intuitive for what works for you. And I know that sounds very woo-woo in California. Like, definitely I arrived from LA today and have a little crystal in my bag.
Don't let anyone else touch it. Yeah. That's yours.
But I do think, yeah, you just, I guess there are ways in which people, I think, create obstacles for themselves and for their artistic creation by doing things that might not be the most natural to them. But I also, I don't know if I'm doing that. You know, I feel like I'm still at the beginning of my career, and things might change and I might grow, or my relationship to language and everything might change because my poems have changed. You know, my poems are quite different now. Not necessarily aesthetically, I feel like there's a through line, but the topics have changed. I don't write that much about war anymore because I just don't know how. Like, I feel like I've exhausted that topic for myself, and I'm still interested in stories of the diaspora and exile and all of these themes, and they've entered my fiction, but the poetry is kind of going in a different direction, which is interesting.
Is, you were thinking of maybe reading a new poem.
Sure.
Is that...
Yes, I can read a new poem. This is called Dirt and Light. Last night it startled me again. I dreamed of the corn maze through which we walked almost a decade ago in the presence of our other lovers. It was all burnt down. Purple corn glowed in the fields enveloping the ruined maze, the woodlands washed by October sun. Instead of you, I found in the salt white music
of that familiar landscape, an old piano, hollowed by the draft of time, and the handle of a porcelain cup and scorched soil, relics of an imagined civil life. Today, in the lemony light by your grave, I recited Merrill. Why did I flinch? I loved you. Then touched the damp and swelling mud, blue hyacinths your mother planted there. Ants were swarming the unfinished plot of earth like the black text of an infinite alphabet. I couldn't read it. There was no epiphany, just dirt, the vast curtain between this realm and the other. You never speak to me, I thought, not even in dreams. For hours I sat there, mocked by the bees. Silly girl, their golden faces laughed. She still wants and wants. A warm gust shook the trees, and a pigeon settled into the dusk of a wet pine, and then another.
Thank you. Thank you, Aria.
You're welcome.
And that was called Dirt and Light.
Mm-hmm.
We have to take a short break, okay, but when we come back, can we talk about Dirt and Light?
Absolutely.
Okay, today on Living Writers, Aria Aber is here. You've got Living Writers, as I just said. I'm T. Hetzel, and we'll be back. Welcome back. You've got Living Writers, and today Aria Aber is here, and you're just in time to catch the last quarter of the show. So I'm glad you tuned in, and I think we have sports up next, the sports folks. And Aria, before the break, you had read a new poem, Dirt and Light. So your work is feeling like it's going, like the themes are different.
The themes are different, yes. Well, I think it goes back to something that I was talking about earlier, how the pandemic, I feel like, just changed me as a person, but also introduced new themes and obsessions into my life by, I guess I can just talk about it because it's this topic is a big part of the next poetry collection. A friend of mine died, and thank you, in 2020. It's almost 4 years ago now, and he died by suicide. And I just remember, like, I hadn't spoken to him in a couple of years, but we were very, very close growing up, and he was like a cousin to me, you know. At that point, I just took that person for granted somehow in my life, and that loss really, really shaped me, and just I couldn't write about anything else anymore suddenly. And the poems were a way to try to understand what had happened, but also this very new kind of grief overtook the macroscopic and expansive grief that I was experiencing before in my youth, and that formed Heart Damage, which was the grief of, like, the loss of the home country. And it became just zoned in kind of into, like, or zoomed into this one person whom I lost, but who was also an exile in Germany, you know, and was, like, often the only other dark-haired person in the same room. And I guess that grief just shaped my poetics now, and I feel like the poems are the only way to make sense of it somehow. It also influenced the novel that I wrote in some way. You know, I had started the novel before it had happened, but it was about a time in my life when that friendship was very important, and it just changed the texture of what I was writing about. But I think it's normal that the older you get and, you know, the things that happen, like life happens and life enters the page. And I think, I guess I'm still figuring out what to make of it in terms of aesthetics, but the themes have changed.
Yes. I am so sorry for your loss, Aria.
Thank you.
A person that feels like it's like the unexpected, like you don't even know that you're like assuming that they'll be with you through life or like a very large chunk of it.
Yes.
And then
it wasn't, in some ways the pandemic was interesting because it created these sudden losses for so many people in different ways, and it affected the mental health of so many people. It was just a strange time and a time of hope too, which was obviously not fulfilled, like that we could restructure the way we lived and move away from this capitalistic death machine that we're trapped in all together. But yeah, it just didn't, it's sad that it didn't work out, but I don't know. I feel like we're still going through it. You know, I don't think it's over. Whatever transformation was happening on the collective consciousness level is still happening.
It's happening,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Yes.
Because how can we really understand it?
Right.
Yeah. And everybody coming to it at wherever they are in their life continuum can be so vastly different.
I know. Yeah.
Well, that poem was beautiful, Dirt and Light. And I can see how, I think from what I can remember here is that you call on Meryl as well, which is interesting because that's one of the threads from Heart Damage, isn't it?
Yes, as the conversation with the dead poets, that the ancestor poets that come before me or came before me. Totally. I mean, that's and I think I did that in that poem, and I have done it in a couple of other new poems. And I'm trying to stay away from it because I also just don't want to, you know, I'm like a magpie. I'm like, here's a line. But oftentimes the line just stays with me. And triggers the poem, and I want to talk back to the dead, you know, and I want to talk back to these writers who seem to be my friends and who give me so much, and I want, you know, like I want to add to the conversation, and it feels like a beautiful way of, first of all, like, yeah, paying homage to someone who has shaped you, but also conjuring that writer into your work and making them alive again a little bit.
Yes, returning their voices to the page with your voice.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can't think of anything better, especially to be so clear about it, like to understand that it's happening and to know that it's part of what you value.
Right.
Is seeking out these voices that are with you.
Yeah. And sometimes they're complicated figures like Rilke, you know? And sometimes I'm not happy about the voice that has shaped me.
You can't choose your family.
Exactly.
Right?
Like, exactly.
You can't, this writing family.
Exactly.
In some ways.
Yeah. That's so true.
And it feels like in Hard Damage and now in the new work, it feels like family is such a critical part. And in your acknowledgments, though, I will say you note that you would choose all of them again.
I would. Yeah. I have an incredible family and I love them. And I know that they seem more complex on the page, but I'm blessed that I was raised with so much love despite the complications that the world and like warfare has thrust upon us. But I have a very wonderful and supportive family, as I've said,
And that is true on both sides, my paternal side and my maternal side too, like not just my immediate nuclear family of parents and sister, but all the cousins as well, and the aunts and the uncles. And sometimes it can feel very hard because there's so many voices in my head, you know? Like I hear the voices of the aunts and I hear the voices of the uncles and I feel their eyes, and it's not always, yeah, as I said, it can be complicated. But I think in order to make art, I just have to forget that they're real, you know? And there is a kind of divide happening mentally, because if I were constantly conscious of the fact that they are there and they might read what I'm writing, then I would not write anything. And I think it's important for any young writer or anyone to just not think about it. And it, maybe that's where I become an art monster and unethical, because I do not care. there are certain things that I would not put on the page, but most of the time I think you have to just go for it.
In one of the poems, Aria, you mentioned that this idea of like being perceived, and I think it's from family, of the good girl does this, and then the woman does this, and how can I be both and to be in the world,
right?
Does that connect to the novel, that good girl that will be
100%.
Could you give us, like, because we have like a couple minutes, like, to talk about Good Girl that will be coming out in 2025?
Yes. Good Girl will be coming out in 2025 from Hogarth here in the US, I think in February or March. And so about a year from now, exactly. And I'm currently translating the novel into German. And it is called Good Girl. It is kind of... it's an evocative title, but it's also referring a phrase in Dari or Farsi, which we use in Afghan culture, which is Dokhtar Khub, which literally just means good girl. And you have to be, you know, a girl who behaves and who is not a Dokhtar Kharab, which is a broken girl, who would probably do things that are quite normal for a Western woman, but under the cultural eye of like a very traditionalist Afghan family are unacceptable. And my family is liberal, but there are still traditions that I was rebelling against, and a lot of them are misogynistic or... yeah, they're not, they just hinder, or they're not equal between men and women. And I think I was a very rebellious and angry child. And those are topics that come up. I guess there are a lot of feminist tendencies that I have, or questions, which are in the book. The book is also about Berlin, the city of Berlin, and its architecture. And the underbelly of Berlin, parallel societies, not just the parallel society of like immigrant culture, but also the parallel society of like club culture and drug culture, that's very prevalent in Berlin. And
so not even East-West sort of ideas, or the architecture of war.
It comes in also, the East-West I mean, it is interesting because I think even now, so many years after the wall fell, there are certain people who warn you from going to certain neighborhoods in the East because of like there are more people who have right-wing tendencies or something. So that's just still true, unfortunately. I don't want to be reductive, right. but it's also not there. Like, we can't be blind to the reality either. I know that there is a tendency in German society, especially among people in Berlin, to want to forego that distinction, but it's there and it's present, and if you're a person of color, you notice it. So
And Good Girl, that's its setting.
That's its setting. It's Berlin in 2010, 2011. Actually, and what the backdrop is, and then we can... Okay, whatever. The backdrop is nothing.
Well, no, it's something. And maybe we can talk next year around this time.
Yes, exactly.
That would be, I would love it. Today on Living Writers, Aria Aber is here. Her book of poems, Hard Damage, out with University of Nebraska Press. I'm Tee Hetzel. We've had Jason behind the glass. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Until next time.
Live from Ann Arbor, this is the Daily Sports Report here on WCBN 88.3 FM Ann Arbor. I'm your host, Vihan Iswar, and I'm joined by a fantastic panel of Jonas Tompkin and Kobe Siegel. Jonas, Kobe, just for an icebreaker, tell us one thing you've been doing to enjoy this gorgeous weather we've been getting the past few days.
Well, I've been, walking a lot, going on strolls, as per usual. Just trying to get my vitamin D in, you know. I'm not always... not too keen to go out into the sun when it's really cold, but you know, trying to enjoy this nice weather. Hopefully, it lasts.
I've been watching college basketball.
Nice. You know, sometimes you could use the weather being too hot as an excuse to just stay in and make yourself a nice glass of iced tea and just do absolutely nothing.
I agree.
Me personally, I threw around football with some friends, but